Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast Programming Languages and Techniques for Today's Embedded and IoT World. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speakers, Nick Butler with National Instruments and Walter Capitani from Rogue Wave Software. Nick Butler is a Senior Product Marketing Group Manager with National Instruments. He leads a team of marketers responsible for the data acquisition and control business at National Instruments. With over 10 years of experience in the industry, Nick has led efforts in go-to-market strategy, sales enablement, messaging, and he's a passionate evangelist for the internet, industrial Internet of Things. Walter Capitani is the Clockwork Product Manager for Rogue Wave Software. Walter's diverse industry experience encompasses high-speed satellite radio communications, file distribution applications for broadcast television and cinema, and 3D video compression and transmission technology. Over the last decade, Walter has managed the development and deployment of large content distribution systems for customers like PBS, CBS, Westwood One, Best Buy, and Deluxe Digital Cinema. Although his favorite programming language is C++, he has experimented with Assembler, Java, Basic, and others, but feels that you cannot beat the original, which I would tend to agree with. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentations. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material and the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A, and if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you could submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Nick will be kicking things off today. Nick, the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you, Kurt. And welcome, everybody, and thank you for joining us today. As mentioned, my name is Nick Butler. I work for National Instruments, and I'm excited to talk to you all today about programming languages and techniques for today's embedded and IoT world. So as we all know, the Internet of Things is about hyper-connected devices, from cars to coffee makers, even clothes. But in the industrial IoT, these devices that are connected are industrial assets and infrastructure systems. We see some examples on the slide. These could be smart factories, smart test systems, smart agricultural vehicles, or even smart infrastructure like the power grid. And the industrial IoT really has enhanced requirements from the consumer or just the regular IoT for things like synchronization and reliability and security because of the type of assets and infrastructure we're talking about. So these enhanced requirements really make designing and programming IIoT systems quite challenging. And if we think about it specifically from a software development perspective, designing the software for these systems is a time and resource intensive task. Traditional approaches involve a myriad of tools, backgrounds, and expertise to really achieve a complete system. Then, of course, you have to deploy the software to a variety of targets, and typically you have to design, test, and debug with different tool chains. And this is, of course, costly and can be really inefficient. And in particular, one type of target that can be especially valuable to IoT systems is an FPGA, and that's because of its ability to perform deterministic parallel operation for all kinds of things like control algorithms or signal processing. But FPGAs have historically been very difficult to incorporate because of their complexity and the expertise required to program them. And incorporating these really powerful devices is growing even more challenging. The industry trend is moving towards heterogeneous and massively parallel systems on a chip, or SoCs. And these typically include the programmable logic and programmable interconnect that you would find on more traditional FPGAs, plus microprocessors, plus DSP cores, and plus peripheral and memory interfaces. So they're growing more and more complex every day because of Moore's Law. And the Xilinx Zynq family of SoCs is a really great example of this trend. It combines a dual-core ARM processor with reconfigurable gates and fabric and 220 DSP slices. So to unlock the power of these incredible devices, you need software that allows you to incorporate advanced features for IIoT systems, along with the productivity and approachability that really your business and your development team requires. And that's where the NI platform-based approach comes to the rescue. So our software-centric platform allows you to target multiple deployment targets and hardware products from a single development environment to solve IIoT applications ranging from test to monitoring to control. This open, extensible, and intuitive LabVIEW development environment is at the center of our platform. And from LabVIEW, you can incorporate code from other languages, such as C or Python or .m files. You can interface with IIoT cloud protocols, such as AMQP or MQTT. You can also communicate with industrial field buses like Profinet, HART, or EtherCAT, which are very common out in industry and in brownfield applications. You can also perform inline signal processing, complex control, and mathematics and data logging, all with built-in APIs and function libraries. And of course, you can even program FPGAs and complex systems on a chip in an intuitive graphical environment without any knowledge of hardware description languages like VHDL or Verilog. So with a platform-based approach, really you can leverage off-the-shelf tools that are still completely customizable. You can choose from a variety of modular hardware targets to meet the size and price and performance requirements of your application. You get completely built and validated hardware and software integration right out of the box. You can access a complete and consistent tool chain for any IIoT application and any phase of the design cycle, whether it be from simulation and modeling to prototyping, validation, or deployment. And of course, no platform, by our definition, really is complete without a complete ecosystem of users and IP, add-ons, and toolkits. And the NI platform really has it all. Now, another element, key element of the NI platform is hardware. And we have a variety of targets based on what we call the LabVIEW Rio architecture. And this architecture combines a processor, a user programmable FPGA, and I/O, or input-output systems. And this architecture is really ideal for the IIoT because it solves the computation, connectivity, and control requirements that we very often see with our customers that are implementing industrial IoT systems and applications. And the beauty of our platform, and in particular the LabVIEW software, which is at the heart of it, is that you can use LabVIEW to target and program each device in the architecture stack instead of using what we might call the more traditional approach, which is different languages, different compilers, different tools to target different devices, and then you have to piece them all back together. So through LabVIEW, we can target the processors for computation and connectivity. We can target and program the FPGAs for complex control, for customized timing, and even inline signal processing. And we can target and program the I/O interfaces for connectivity to sensors, to protocols, to databases, and of course to the enterprise or for the cloud for industrial IoT systems. LabVIEW really is the ideal software for industrial IoT applications. It has that built-in hardware support, system management tools, and hundreds upon hundreds of function libraries to perform any type of mathematics, analysis, file I/O, data logging, and integration with other systems. It also has a complete ecosystem of users, developers, as well as IP and add-ons and toolkits, even those that are specific to industrial IoT applications like cloud connectivity APIs, database connectivity toolkits, and other analysis and analytics, and even machine learning and deep learning add-ons that are actually coming soon to the platform. So LabVIEW is really at the forefront of the platform and at the forefront of what our customers are doing to implement industrial IoT innovation in the marketplace. A newer feature that we'd like to discuss with you today of the NI platform is NI Linux Real-Time, which brings together the reliability and the determinism of the preempt RT patch really together with the openness of Linux. And NI collaborates with other companies and organizations within the Linux Foundation and the Yocto project to drive uniformity within the embedded community on how to build Linux for embedded applications. So we have really strong partnerships with folks like Google, TI, ARM, Intel, and IBM, and others to deliver this open source deterministic operating system that is supported on a variety of our hardware products and is customizable and programmable with LabVIEW, along with some other programming languages as well. We can see some examples of those programming languages on the slide here. And that's one of the biggest reasons that we moved our platform to Linux, is that ecosystem that surrounds this open source operating system. So there's tools like compilers and interpreters, runtime engines, for really any programming language that you want to use. So with the openness of Linux and the openness of LabVIEW, you really have a combined hardware-software platform that allows you to choose your language, choose your protocol that you want to develop with, and bring it all together through a tested and validated platform that combines not only hardware and software, but an ecosystem of users and IP. As I mentioned earlier, we have a multitude of hardware targets that all support and run NI Linux Real-Time that are all targetable and programmable with LabVIEW. You can choose the form factor, the price point, and the performance options that you need to meet your specific IIoT application. This could be in the lab. This could be on the factory floor. This could be out deployed on the electrical grid, or even on a smart agricultural vehicle. It could even be kind of in the design phase of your IoT product, and it could be a test system or an HIL simulation system. So all of this hardware can be deployed in various environments in various ways, but all targetable and customizable through a single development environment and software stack. So to close and summarize, the NI software-centric platform really is ideal for the industrial Internet of Things. It gives you an accelerated starting point with pre-validated hardware and software that's completely customizable through the software environment. It provides the capabilities that you need for industrial IoT applications, the computation, the connectivity, and the control that we see in all of those applications. It also allows you to leverage a consistent software environment for designing and testing every element of industrial IoT systems, including integration with existing devices and infrastructure, which are commonly known as brownfield systems or installations. So that's all for me today. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll kick it back to you, Kurt.
Great. Thanks a lot, Nick. Our next speaker is Walter Capitani. Walter.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for attending. My name is Walter Capitani. I am the product manager for the Clockwork Static Code Analysis product line here at Rogue Wave Software. And what we are going to talk about today is the challenges around securing and creating robust embedded IoT systems and backend systems. So that's really our challenge. Just a quick look at the agenda here. We're going to look at this problem of security and interoperability. We're going to discuss selecting a programming language to use in these projects. And then we're going to take a dive into how we can improve testing with static code analysis, develop policies and procedures around security, and using the use of safe coding standards. So without further ado, let's dive right into it. So our problem that we're looking at today is how do we achieve secure and robust interoperability between embedded IoT systems and backend systems? And so what we want to do is use software development processes and tools that can help us accomplish this mission. We want to choose languages or a language that is really supports the creation of robust software. And finally, we want to select a language that is supported by sophisticated automated tools to help our developers when they're creating new software. And so we think that C and C++ is a programming language that meets those criteria. There may be others, but we feel that in terms of mission critical for security and robustness, C and C++ really has everything we're looking for in a language. So restating the problem then is, how do we use C and C++ to develop secure and robust embedded IoT software? So let's take a look first of all at the language choice. So why C and C++? Well, C and C++ are already used in many mission critical and safety critical environments. So this allows us and our organizations to reuse well-known software development techniques, and these techniques have already been proven in safety-critical and mission-critical environments. We have a large choice of development tools, platforms, and libraries to aid in development of code. And finally, we've also got a wide selection of tools that can help us increase the security and robustness of software. And, you know, a recent survey says that C and C++ is one of the top 10 most popular languages. I think it's been that way for a long time now. It may not be the top in terms of new code generation, but it's certainly still very popular. And so that means it's going to have a lot of support from the industry. A second issue is when we look at development is that developers are not trained for security. So these graduates that we have coming out of computer science and software engineering don't really know how to develop software to prevent or to neutralize security threats. They're great at developing new algorithms and developing, you know, the features that we want, and that's what we want them to be doing. But they really don't have a strong skill set to defend and code their software to prevent attacks. Typically, we might turn to reformed hackers, for example, to help us test for vulnerabilities, but they can only do this testing after the code is compiled and completed. So that means that we're going to find a bunch of defects, security issues, later on in the development process. So that means that we'll have security issues in our code base, and we've got to detect them after they've been introduced, and then we need to fix them. So this reduces our developer productivity, of course, because now they're going back and doing rework on their code. So another factor is we might say, well, why don't we train our developers? Well, security training is expensive. You might have to send a developer away for a week or 2 weeks just to get, you know, the fundamentals. And then, so of course, you've got a loss, instant loss in productivity. But then, of course, you've got to keep repeating that training as they add new platforms to the product or support new environments. You're going to have new types of threats, new attack vectors. And then, of course, we have this, you know, constantly emerging new threats against existing platforms. So that means you're continually going to have to be retraining and upgrading the training of your developers for security. So recently there was a study by the Ponemon Institute that suggests that developers want to make their code more secure, but they don't have the security training necessary to do so. And furthermore, if you look at the stats there, only 45% indicated that their development process process includes any activity that supports security requirements. Less than 50% agree that secure software is a priority for the company, and almost 70% believe that securing applications is difficult to very difficult. So I think if we look at the results of that survey, our developers are saying we want to do something, we know we should do something, but we don't know how to do it. The other factor around security defects is that, most defects are introduced in the development phase of software. In other words, very few defects are created in the integration phase, or in the deployment phase. Most defects are introduced by the actual coding of the software. However, in a lot of legacy development environments, your defects are only detected as a post-development QA or production testing. And of course, this will increase the cost of fixing these defects because now they've been in the code, you've tested the code, you've validated that all your features and functionality work, then you do this security scanning and, somebody throws up the red flag and says, oh no, we've got to go back and fix the defects. And this, of course, once we open that code, your QA people will say, well, we've got to retest all of the features now to make sure we haven't broken anything, right? Then when we look at production, if we find defects in production, so a customer might report a security defect to you or, a worst case scenario, there's actual legitimate breach in the system, that's in production, then this gets much more expensive because now you've involved everybody that touches customers as well as the QA team. You've got to reproduce this defect. You've got to communicate, the vulnerability to all your other customers that may not know about it. And then you still have to fix it in the end. So you've still got that cost of fixing the defect, but you had added on all these other communication and other costs, testing, reproduction issues down the road. So it's a lot more expensive. And what, we find, we talk to customers, is that, these kind of hidden costs that are not considered in the cost of a security issue can be greater than many times greater than the cost of fixing the issue itself. So, we propose that the solution is to improve testing, and one of the ways that we can improve testing is by using static code analysis. We want to see organizations implement a zero-tolerance policy on security issues. And finally, we want to implement standards that are, reuse standards from other industries that can make code more secure as well as more reliable. So how can static code analysis help? Well, static code analysis is great at finding common issues in code that lead to reliability or security issues. These can be anything from security exploits or items that make your program crash. They can be issues that cause the program to run out of memory or processor to run out of memory, which could be a denial of service, for example. Or you can look at issues like data injection, where you've got security vulnerabilities with bad data or malicious data being injected into your system. So static code analysis tools detect these things by looking at the errors that allow these defects to exist, such as buffer overflows, memory leaks, concurrency issues. These are the underlying programming defects that give us security and quality issues in the field. And one of the advantages of static code analysis, it is very good at finding these kinds of issues that are hard to spot with the human eye. I think most of us, if we're given a simple security issue like SQL injection, we can spot it fairly easily if that data is, input from the same function where we're going to use it. So, your SQL injection is contained within 2-3 lines of code. But when you get into the real world, much more complex interfaces, complex GUIs, products, you have apps that are taking data in and then making calls to third-party libraries, it gets trickier to find those issues. And you've got to spend a lot more time tracing through and ensuring that you have, kind of a valid path and that all data has been, cleaned of possible tainted data before you use it. And this is where static code analysis can really help. And it finds issues that are traditionally found with dynamic testing or after a failure in the field. So for those that might be new to static code analysis, you might be wondering, well, how does it work? Well, static code analysis is, the word static means that it does not run the code. So it's not a debugger. It's not a penetration testing tool that will will probe the running software and try to find weaknesses. Instead, static code analysis is inspecting source code and is looking for defects based on its understanding of how the source code would be compiled and how it would run, but it never actually executes the code. So as a result, it finds different defects than your penetration testing might find, because a lot of the testing, dynamic testing that you do, it requires a test case that exercises the code in a specific way, and your test case might not cover something that might happen in the field, and therefore static code analysis can find defects that you might not see until you get into production. So as a result, static code analysis must be able to compile your code and ideally doesn't make any changes to the existing build process of the software, so that the resulting model generated by the static code analysis tool is the same as what your compiler is going to do. Static code analysis also can perform many different kinds of analysis. It can be simple single line of code analysis, which is good for finding kind of coding style issues, and then a more sophisticated data flow and control flow analysis between procedures or even between files to give you the most accurate defect finding. And I like to always say that, you know, a static code analysis tool, it writes the tests that your developers don't want to write or won't write. In other words, you know, a extremely complicated test to determine if you have a memory leak, that's built into a static code analysis tool like Clockwork. And as a result, it'll find defects that other testing won't. So talking about the Clockwork static code analysis engine, it contains hundreds of checkers for multiple programming languages. In this case, for C and C++, certainly a large number of checkers for security, a large number of checkers for reliability, and then checkers that are grouped into coding standards, both for quality and security. So making it easy for a user to select which standards they'd like to be compliant with, and then using the tool to look for defects that are associated with those standards. So for example, for security, a very common standard used is the CWE, common weakness enumeration, and security tools will have checkers that will look for defects that map to that standard. Another key feature of Clockwork to help with the, the workload that developers are facing is a new feature called SmartRank. So SmartRank is a defect triage and filtering feature that helps developers choose which defects they're going to work on. For anyone that's used any kind of testing tool, you know, you'll get a lot of results that you have to investigate, and sometimes it's hard to tell, well, which results should I look at first? So you might look at, you know, the criticality of the defect or maybe where it is in the code, but this can be a long process. And for new developers to the organization and growing organizations, these are things they have to learn. What SmartRank does is it provides a recommendation as to which defects developers should look at first based on the type of defect, how it's found in the code, and the value it's going to bring to the user by correcting it. And the idea is that the best defects to work on, the ones that will give the developer kind of the most bang for their buck of the time they spend correcting defects, will be at the top and most recommended part of the list. And the SmartRank feature is fully integrated with the rest of the Clockwork reporting aspect, so you can use existing views, modules, which are, you know, kind of groupings of code, and other filters. You can use it in conjunction with SmartRank. So if you've already identified, for example, that you'd like to look for memory leaks, you can still use the SmartRank feature to rank those memory leak defects that are found in order of most recommended to work on. So Clockwork static code analysis provides a workflow for any kind of software development organization, from a small, 5 to 10 person team, all the way to multiple hundreds of developers working on large projects. This includes support for continuous integration systems. So this is the kind of fastest defect detection available for integration builds. That way each check-in can be scanned as it's checked in and can be gated, so that if a check-in of a developer creates a security issue, that check-in can be rejected, for example. Clockwork also offers desktop analysis, so that you can do an integration analysis right on your desktop whenever you save code or modify code. This allows, of course, the cleanest code to be checked in, since a defect will never even make it to the integration build. And finally, there are standalone modes available as well for small projects and small teams. as well as, you know, those doing a traditional kind of audit or compliance type type scanning. So the second point around security, other than using static code analysis, is this zero tolerance policy on security issues. So, for example, many software development organizations that are using Clockwork have basically enabled security and quality defects that they think are important to their projects, and they've said, we will not release if we have any of these issues detected by the tool. We've got to investigate these issues, correct them, and make sure we have a clean scan before we release. So in the CI model, if some changed or new code actually has security issues in it, many organizations are rejecting those check-ins so that the build can always be maintained with no security issues in it. This kind of policy makes sure that security issues are caught as early as possible in the development cycle. That means you have the most time to educate the developer, maybe if they're a new developer or new to the organization in terms of how that organization develops code. You can educate them on how to fix such a kind of defect. And this means that without any security issues in the integration build, the build is never broken. So our third strategy that we recommend is to use safe coding standards. So Clockwork ships with a number of coding standards built into it, which allows the developers to enable, let's say, the relevant standards. So, for example, security standards like DSA-STIG or CWE, or, for example, quality standards like the automotive MISRA standards or other safe coding standards like CERT. It enables those developers to enable the standards in their static code analysis. What this means is they don't have to be security experts. The security experts at Clockwork can help them decide what checkers to use, recommend those checkers, and then they can correct those defects as they go along, making sure that they have the least, you know, the best quality software and the most secure software at all times. So that's it for me. Back to you, Kurt.
Great. Thanks, Walter. Nick, we have plenty of time for questions. We are to the Q&A now. A couple of really interesting topics here in terms of FPGAs and their use within the IIoT environment, how there's a development tool chain that brings like unprecedented flexibility, really, and I want to get into it with Nick. And then, of course, the static analysis and a security dimension where security and authentication is, you know, very important within IIoT, especially because of the mission-critical nature. So let's start with Nick start with an FPGA question here. Can you talk about the end-to-end IoT chain from, you know, device to gateway to cloud application and analytics, along with also mobile, the mobile device dimension, and what customers use FPGAs for within that environment?
Sure. Can you still hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. So typically, I have a slide that I didn't include in this webinar, but typically we describe IIoT systems as having kind of four elements to it. The first is the things themselves, right? We're talking about the industrial Internet of Things. So these things are assets. You know, it could be a turbine, could be a manufacturing machine, could be a recloser at an electrical substation. That's kind of element number one. Element number two in building this up is we outfit those things with sensors and sometimes even actuators for motion. So we might monitor pressures or flows. We might monitor vibrations. We might want to control motion systems or gantry systems. So we have our things. We've instrumented them with sensors and actuators. Then we kind of bolt on our controllers and our data acquisition systems, right? So we have to get information from the sensors. We have to send information to the actuators. So we need intelligence, and we need this intelligence at what we call the edge. So the edge is a term that you'll hear a lot when you talk about the IoT or the IIoT, and that's really where the enterprise kind of meets the asset. It's almost, you can almost think of it as where the network connection meets the asset, whether that's Wi-Fi or Ethernet or next generation Ethernet. So you have this intelligent system at the edge, which is capable of processing, it's capable of analytics, it's capable of running control algorithms, it's capable of data reduction, and this is really where NI's products live. They live at the edge. They're rugged, they're industrially rated, so they can be deployed into these manufacturing environments, to electrical substations, for example. And we have the connectivity to link up to those sensors and actuators. So this is typically where the FPGA will live. It will live at the edge on the controller or the kind of the smart computer that you could also call it. You could also call it a gateway, as you mentioned. And this FPGA is going to be very versatile for you. And really, you can program it to do whatever you'd like it to do. The beauty of the FPGA as opposed to a processor is that the FPGA is not governed by an operating system. It does not kind of subscribe to the lack of determinism that an operating system-driven processor might. It is hardware reliability, customizable through software. So it has the utmost determinism. So whatever your critical routines are that you want to run at the edge, maybe that's multiple control algorithms for a six-axis gantry system on a manufacturing machine, you could run that in the FPGA. If you want to do extremely fast signal or image processing in parallel to perhaps some control algorithms, all of that can go onto your FPGA. To just kind of complete the answer to your question, the next phase of the architecture beyond the edge is really the enterprise, and that's where we can connect up to the business's infrastructure and their IT or their OT systems, as well as the fog or the cloud through a variety of different protocols, databases, and interfaces. So it's those four main levels of the IIoT system. And the FPGA and NI products really live at the edge, and then we have the integration and the openness and extensibility to connect kind of upstream and downstream in that architecture.
Okay, great. Thanks, Nick. Walter, I want to combine a couple of questions here. One is, do you recommend any kind of CICD and development environments to use? And then kind of an associated question with that is, can you provide an example of how you do fit code analysis and security checking within a CICD environment? You mentioned, kicking it off as developers are developing and prior to check-in. Is there merit to doing it after merges in case certain merges of source code end up causing security issues somehow or adding, code analysis bugs or what have you?
Sure, great question, Kurt. I'll start with the recommendation on CI/CD systems. I've always had a philosophy going back to the age-old question is Windows or Linux, is you should use the tools that your organization is more familiar with because ultimately you'll be able to do more and get the most out of those tools. I think if you're using Jenkins, that's a great choice. If you're using TeamCity, that's a great choice. But if you're using TFS and that works for your organization, then by all means, right? So I think that's my answer there. I recommend the one that you know the best for the organization. Now, moving into how we fit it into CI/CD, there's no question that the sooner that you find a defect, the less costly it is to fix. So, one of the things, if I could just digress into desktop versus CI for a minute, one of the reasons we've seen a shift, a little bit of a shift towards CI in general, is because of the complexity of maintaining desktop compile environments. And again, this is very organization-specific. So if it's easy to do desktop compiling and analysis for your particular application, then by all means, it's a great solution. But sometimes, the complexity and with remote employees and bring your own hardware, it's just getting tougher and tougher to maintain that desktop build environment. So that's where CI slots in really nicely, where you can get all the advantages of a desktop analysis, which is a quick and speedy analysis that gives you a list of defects on the code that you've changed, without having to maintain that desktop build environment. So that's one of the nice things about doing a CI static code analysis versus desktop analysis. And in terms of when do we do it, I think gating on check-ins is really great for organizations that are concerned about security, because there's kind of this feeling in general that security issues don't make it into our integration build. And, you know, as we look at cycle times getting shorter in terms of releases, you want to reduce that amount of post-development release work that you have to do, ideally to zero, right? So this is a technique that helps you maintain a zero security issue policy without causing undue delays in the release cycle. You talked about branches and feature branches. For sure, if you've got multiple feature branches underway, doing a static code analysis before a merge is a great time to do it. Certainly, again, we'd recommend you use desktop analysis anyway, so to reduce any issues you have, you know, as you're developing your code. But certainly, once you're about to merge that feature branch onto the main branch, that's a great place to do a CI build as well, and just preventatively, you know, stop that merge before you've got any security issues in the main branch.
Okay, great, thanks. Number of questions relating to protocols and how that fits into the environment. So I want to start with Nick and then also let Walter chime in on this as well. So there's a question about what about the protocols and what protocols are we using? Now, you know, there's a lot of Bluetooth, USB, Wi-Fi, LTE, you know, at the edge going up through ultimately Internet. Does that make it tough to use an FPGA, or can the FPGAs kind of do some kind of protocol interfacing, or do you rely on equipment to kind of do the transmission and then the FPGA operates on it?
Sure. So the nice thing about the LabVIEW Rio architecture, which combines the processor, the FPGA, and the I/O in a variety of kind of hardware form factors, price points and performance points. The beauty of having that kind of multifaceted architecture is you can partition your application how you see fit. So the signal processing, advanced timing, triggering, image processing, control algorithms, those things would go on the FPGA. Mm-hmm. Your protocol interfaces would likely live on the processor. And the NI platform and LabVIEW has support for countless protocols, from the industrial field buses, you know, Ethernet IP, HART, EtherCAT, so on and so forth, to some of the growing in popularity cloud protocols like AMQP or MQTT. We have support for industry-specific protocols, so IEC 61850 or DNP3 for energy applications. We have toolkits and APIs for all of these different protocols so that you can communicate from LabVIEW to whatever other device that you have in your system. Maybe it's a PLC, maybe it's a database, maybe it's enterprise cloud, you know, and then of course all the standard, TCP/IP, RS-232, RS-485, you know, all these other kind of standard protocols and interfaces all have their own APIs and function blocks within LabVIEW. But most of that, to come back to your question, will live on the processor. And that allows you to partition your application and put really the most time-intensive or critical or deterministic or reliable elements of your application on the FPGA.
Okay, great. Thanks, Nick. Walter, in terms of protocols and potential security holes, security risks, can these code analysis tools help with protocols as well?
Well, for sure, Kurt. Certainly a lot of the security risks are running over TCP/IP protocol, as you'd expect, coming in on APIs, either REST APIs or SOAP APIs. So certainly they can really help there. One of the big concerns, of course, is around tainted data, and that's something that static code analysis and particularly Clockwork can help with, is identifying situations where tainted data is being used where it shouldn't, particularly in the IIoT, where you might be using the command line, for example, to drive a device or configure a device, so you're getting settings and commands over the API, and then you're translating that into some sort of command line executable, probably some legacy executable that already works, and now you're hooking it up to the internet. That's a great vector for tainted data to get into the system and either do something malicious on a command line or just, you know, bring a device down, for example, by, you know, putting in a bad configuration or something like that. So for sure, that vector of attack is one that static code analysis can help help protect.
Okay, great. Thanks, Walter. Nick, programming languages. What programming languages does the LabVIEW support?
That's a pretty long list. We have support for, of course, the native G Dataflow language within LabVIEW. We have support for the CodeAssist environment, so 6.11.31 languages. We have support for the Eclipse environment, native support for Eclipse, so C and C++. We have support for .m files and scripting. We also just released support for Python. So I would start there. I think those are some of the most popular out there. There is some other add-ons and toolkits that are developed by some of our ecosystem and partner network as well for some of the other languages that are out there, but I would say those are the most commonly used languages that I just mentioned.
Okay, great. Thanks, Nick. Also want to take a minute to remind the audience, you can still ask questions. We've got a number of them, really good ones so far, but again, I want to remind the audience you can still submit your questions and get some expertise here. Security, Walter. So there are security issues you mentioned. What kinds of security issues are the most common for IIoT? Like, do the security requirements differ between industry, medical versus assembly line versus home entertainment? I know this would be a session in itself, but maybe you can kind of briefly describe kinds of the differences and what kinds of security issues are the most common.
Sure. So when you look at the security issues, like I mentioned previously, I think tainted data is one of the big ones because we've got this mix of old and new code in a lot of these devices, you know, legacy platforms that we're trying to reuse as much as possible for efficiency. And so we're suddenly connecting something that, you know, maybe was only connected to a human interface before. Now we've put a machine interface on it, and suddenly that opens up an attack vector, you know, on your, whether it's your Wi-Fi in your home or, you know, some Wi-Fi in a plant somewhere where a malicious user might be able to do something. So tainted data is a big one. Another big one which came to light, a year and a half ago in terms of a real-world issue, and we always knew about it, but that's hard-coded credentials. And there was a company that was manufacturing security cameras and, you know, digital security video recording systems, and they used their postal code as the root password. And that's the kind of thing that a static code analysis tool can find, saying you're using a security access or, you're calling a security function using hard-coded credentials. And that's a major issue, especially with legacy devices where you've got, for example, passwords, usernames and passwords that are used in a test environment. You noted in the introduction I came from a broadcast background. Well, you know, when you're producing hardware, you've got to somehow configure these devices in your production line before you send them down the road. It is not it's a non-trivial task to configure unique usernames and passwords for every device and then publish those out to the customers, right? And so a lot of organizations will take shortcuts there and hard code them and just say, well, you know, the default admin password is, you know, whatever, or worse, they'll, you know, do what this video camera, DVR company did and use a secret root password that's hard coded, but one that everybody, you know, every employee will know and is easy to remember. So I think, you know, when you talk about security requirements between industries, you know, I think in medical, there's the safety critical side of it where, you know, you wouldn't want some sort of safety critical device to be disabled by, you know, a malicious user or hacker, let's say. But there's also major privacy concerns, right, with so many integrated systems that are, for example, putting out diagnostic images. In this celebrity-crazed world, we can imagine folks trying to access the ultrasound images from a hospital's medical records because it's all electronic going from ultrasound machine into the record system. So major security issues and privacy issues there. Looking into the home, it tends to be more about, you know, the general feeling of privacy that a user might have. I mean, the recent WikiLeaks issue around security of Samsung, for example, Samsung televisions and the microphones and TVs. You know, I mean, in general, there's not a huge security issue there. It's not like you sit in front of your TV reading out your bank card number. But, you know, people do want to feel that they have privacy in their homes, and I think that's an issue there. There's also the issue around content. If you're purchasing content, for example, you wouldn't want content to be stolen off your home entertainment system, for example. So, yeah, I think they do differ. The security requirements do differ depending on safety critical environment or not, and, you know, personal versus professional.
Right. Okay. Nick, in terms of the LabVIEW, what kinds of test debug capabilities are available there? You know, there's functional correctness. Then there's, you know, multi-processor and concurrency issues mm-hmm. you need to check for. And then does it address any kind of cycle-accurate simulation, or are these ecosystem partners, or how does the environment address those things?
So we do have cycle-accurate simulation through an add-on to LabVIEW that's called the Real-Time Execution Trace Toolkit. That allows you to kind of step through your code. We also have, and that's through an add-on. We also have built-in, just native, a feature in LabVIEW that's called Highlight Execution, which allows you to put breakpoints in your code and kind of click through step by step and kind of probe values on each one of your lines within your code, so you can see how values are changing. As inputs and outputs are loaded into your algorithms and your routines, you can see how those change. You can debug and find issues. We also have built-in debugging tools during development. So as you're writing your code, we can call out things that look awry or that won't compile. So you don't actually have to go into compile and wait and then find out later that you had perhaps a syntax error or something like that. Another feature that we're really excited about that we released about a year and a half ago is FPGA co-simulation. I've talked a lot about a lot of the advantages of FPGAs, but admittedly one of the issues with them is that they do have long compile times. So one of the things that you can do to make sure that your code will work and will work properly before you go kick off perhaps a 20-minute compile is that you can do co-simulation. So your desktop, your development PC, actually serves as the FPGA and runs your algorithm on the desktop with real hardware I/O so that you can actually test out the functionality of your code before you even compile it down to the FPGA. So that's a real productivity enhancer and time saver for a lot of customers. So we do have a lot of features that are built into either native LabVIEW or through some of these add-ons for LabVIEW FPGA and LabVIEW Real-Time for some of these more complex and industrial applications.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks. Walter, kind of a general question, is static code analysis better than dynamic code analysis?
Oh, great question. Yeah, great question. I'm going to say yes, static code analysis is the best, but I'd be lying. They're complementary technologies, certainly. I think that, you know, one of the, you know, dynamic analysis, which we use that term, but, you know, if we think about debugging, it's something that all developers need as a tool, right? We all need the ability to figure out where our code is not behaving properly, when it's not behaving properly, and that's something that dynamic analysis is really great at doing. The problem with dynamic analysis, or the weakness, is that you have to actually be able to reproduce the problem you're looking for, right? So if you have an application crash that's environmental dependent, and we see that a lot in inquiries into static code analysis, where we hear the following kind of scenario. Our software works fine in our lab. It works fine in our QA testing, but in the real world, it's crashing, and we don't know why. And so because they don't know why, and they can't reproduce the problem in-house, you're basically, and any software developer on this call will be nodding their head, right? You are stuck now. You have a couple of choices. You could read all of the source code, essentially do a massive code review looking for the issue. You know, hopefully you've got some sort of insight into what the defect might be, and maybe you could find it by looking at code yourself. But if you've got, you know, even a couple hundred thousand lines of code, this is going to take a while, right? And this is where dynamic analysis basically can't help you because you don't know what you're looking for. So if you don't know what you're looking for, dynamic analysis isn't going to help you. But with static code analysis, what you can complement your dynamic analysis is to say, well, what are the likely types of defects that would lead to the issue I'm seeing in the field, and start looking at those, right? And in combination with the new Smart Rank feature, you can look at the most likely ones. And when you find them, say, okay, let's look at the code. You know, perhaps turn on our dynamic analysis and look at what's happening around there and verify, could this situation happen in what we see in the lab? And perhaps you might just fix it anyway and say, okay, I'm going to send it back to my customers because I can't reproduce the situation. These are the kind of things that static code analysis can really help with, the hard-to-find ones.
Okay, good. We're reaching close to the end, so we're going to have to shorten our answers, speakers. I'm sorry, but let's talk about this, and I'm going to ask you one that takes a long time to answer, but I'll kind of chime in and then let Nick and Walter add. So there's a question about, someone's heard that real-time Linux is not truly real-time. Can you please clarify why there is this confusion? And I think, from my understanding, it really boils down to any operating system that uses virtual memory. Because of the operating system's unpredictable virtual memory paging, it inherently makes things non-predictable, where if real-time operating systems are using hard memory maps, that doesn't occur. Do you have any additional information? I mean, maybe we can just provide pointers, or certainly the question asker can reach out to you as well. We'll start with Nick and then go to Walter.
So we have worked really hard to ensure that it is hard real-time operation, and that you do have very bounded jitter and the determinism that you need. We use the preempt RT patch to guarantee this. This is open source information that you can go up and look actually in the branch through the distribution. And we also have a multitude of resources on our website that I would direct folks to learn more about NILinux real-time.
Okay, great. Thanks. Walter, any quick comments on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the definition of real time is always relative to what you are doing, right? So I think if the processor is reliable enough and predictable enough and the software runs in such a way that it provides the functionality you need, the response time you need, and the predictability you need, then that's real time enough for your purpose, right? And so I think that's what you have to evaluate. Obviously, there are lots of proprietary OSs out there that for a cost can provide, you know, perhaps greater predictability or reliability than maybe some of the open source alternatives. But at the end of the day, it's down to what you're designing.
Right. Okay. There's also a question about automation tie-ins to test stand. Can you automatically tie things in, like, you know, as you're writing the code, like the Eclipse systems will do that automatically? Nick?
I am not sure exactly how to answer that question. So we do have a lot of, you know, in-house integration between our systems. You know, LabVIEW and TestStand are actually built on the same underlying code base. But as far as automating the systems and TestStand and IIoT applications, we don't see TestStand a lot in deployed IIoT systems.
Okay.
So that's a tough one. I'd be happy to take that offline.
Sure. Okay.
And discuss that more with the audience member.
Okay, great. Thanks. Just quick question, 20 seconds. If a company's mandated to perform code reviews, how can they combine that with static analysis? Can you give us a 20-second quick thought on that?
That's a quick answer. Yeah, well, I think, you know, code reviews have a great purpose. But static code analysis tools are working alongside your developers every day, right? So I think the issue is code reviews help you make sure features are working the way you want to and that the design makes sense in the overall architecture of the product. Static code analysis tools are looking for those things that you aren't going to find anyway.
Okay, great. Thanks. Thanks, Walter. And, of course, you can also reach out to these people as well, audience. Unfortunately, that brings us to the conclusion of today's eCast. I want to thank Nick and Walter for sharing their insights on programming languages and techniques for today's embedded and IoT world. We at Open Systems Media, National Instruments, and Rogue Wave Software want to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing excellent questions remotely. This podcast will be online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available there. This is all Open Systems Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be used or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.